Hello, and welcome to Reincarnation Past Lives Revisited, where we'll cover one of the many reported cases of reincarnation so we can bring the discussion out into the light about what happens to our souls after death. But before we go too much further, I'd like to thank Alexios Arctos for his amazing sound engineering and editing work, and Raphael Crooks for allowing us to use his music from the freepd.com public domain music site. Today we rejoin Ben B to hear about another life that started to creep up on him while he was coming to grips with Terry's memories. After doing my own regression, I noticed very clear patterns recurring across many of the memories I had in my life. And as I listened to Ben telling me his story of a World War II pilot, I started to wonder if the same thing wasn't happening with Terry and Ray. As we move through the account, it seems to point to me that this life may have been where all of the troubles began, through the last two of Ben's lives. Join us now to hear this interesting case. Today we'd like to welcome Ben back to the program because in researching Terry, he started to get memories of another life. And I want to talk about that life this time around. So welcome back, Ben. It's lovely to have you back again.
I'm glad to be back again, yeah.
Oh, it's amazing having you here, and so many people were blown away by your memories of Terry. But while you were in the middle of dealing with all of that, which was quite a lot, you also started to get other memories, didn't you, of a different life?
Yeah. I have to say, like, at the beginning, I wasn't quite sure sort of what was going on. It's pretty much the same way I was getting memories of my life as Terry. Sometimes I would kind of, I'd be meditating maybe, or I'd just be, my mind would be wandering, or I'd be waking up from sleep, and I would get these kind of flashes of, I think it was kind of like a runway I was seeing, and it didn't look like anything that related to Vietnam. Can't explain why I thought that. I think it was just a general scenario. It was like a hangar type place with concrete. And I would kind of jump out of it. I'd be like, oh, what's that? You know, didn't really want to engage with it. I was like, if this is something else, I don't want to know. But then sometimes I kind of would think, cast my mind back to a little bit just when I was wondering, like, what is that? You know? And, I kind of started to get this visual picture of a man who, again, was American. And in my head, I kind of painted a picture of him being quite tall, having kind of light blondish hair and quite piercing blue eyes. He was quite a good looking guy. but also he was American. And I was thinking, well, what's this, you know? Maybe this guy is a pilot, maybe he's not a pilot, I don't know what this is. And then, as I left that alone for a while, I was talking to some sort of friends that also have their memories of being in World War II, but not as pilots. And I sort of described a little bit of what I was seeing to them, and they were like, well, it's possible you might have lived back then too. For instance, Terry, the man I remembered being during the Vietnam War, he was born December of 1940. And that really doesn't leave a big chunk of time for somebody to have been flying during World War II. Because obviously Americans didn't get involved till much later in World War II. So for me, it was kind of iffy. What's going on? Maybe this is not real. Maybe it's imagination, whatever. And then I think there was some sort of event going on. I'm not sure if it was because it was VE Day. There was something going on. It was like an anniversary. And I remember sort of looking up in the sky, and sometimes where I live in the back garden, you can see sort of historic flyovers like Spitfires or other sort of historic aircraft. So I remember looking up and thinking, maybe I'll see a Spitfire, maybe, you know, something. And then there was this feeling of, there was got this resonance inside me. And I just kept thinking back to this sort of memory I had, and maybe there was something to it, and but then kind of thinking that didn't sort of bring me any answers, you know. So there was this kind of I'll call this kind of the catalyst for the memories, really. I woke up one day. I think I was waking up because I can't remember honestly, but it was probably I was waking up because it's sometimes my mind tends to wander, and I'll get like visuals of things. And I got this very clear image of the interior of a cockpit, and what I could see in front of me was sort of the controls, and it was a fairly big craft inside. And I could see that I had like this yoke. It's called a yoke, you know, this what you use to steer the vehicle. And there was something to my left, like some sort of handle or control. I don't know what it was for, but I seemed to be pulling it upwards as this vehicle was about to take off on this runway. And I remember coming from that sort of vision and thinking, well, what the heck was that? You know, it was very, very vivid. And I was thinking, well, let's look around, see if I can find this aircraft, because it would have been, presuming I was born, I died sometime before December 1940. I needed to look for crafts that could relate to that time period. But I looked around, and I even asked my World War II enthusiast friends who might know more. They didn't seem to come up with any vehicle, and we couldn't find out what it was. So I just put it to one side. I was like, nah, I don't know what this is. And then another time, sometime after that, I had a dream. And this definitely was a dream, because I remember I wrote it down somewhere, that I was at a reunion of Hurricane pilots. I didn't even know fully what a hurricane was. I was like, I don't know. That's how clueless I was. Because World War II, it's never been a direct interest of mine, to be fair. And particularly the early war, I always found it a bit repellent to know about it, to be fair. So yeah, I was at this reunion of Hurricane pilots, and they were all sort of older men. So it was like, these was like a gathering of men that maybe after the war, they would have got together and discussed maybe aspects of the war together. And I kind of seemed to be like disembodied and watching these men. It was quite strange, really.
So you didn't
Yeah.
feel that you were actually alive at that point, or did you feel that you
No.
were watching it from the other side?
Yeah, like as if you were a spirit watching. I don't know, like as if you were kind of an observer in some people getting together, but in a spirit form, that sort of thing. I remember waking up from the dream thinking that was absolutely bizarre, because I also felt in the dream that I belonged there. It was like this feeling of I belong here amongst these people. Again, that I didn't understand what that meant. I remember watching this, you know, I don't know if you've seen it, the movie of Dunkirk. It's done fairly recent, but it was really very extremely kind of realistic, very well done. And in that movie, there's a dogfight that goes on over the, I think it's between English and French, the English Channel. And I remember watching it, and I was getting kind of this kind of reaction that I only ever get usually when I'm thinking about something to do with Vietnam. Like I get this kind of this, I get cold sweats, and I feel shocked when I'm watching. It's like a kind of, I guess, a PTSD type reaction. And I realized afterwards that Dunkirk was pre-1940. It was actually 1939. So my subconscious was getting the message. It's quite possible I could have lived and then died as a pilot early on in the war, then moved on to who I was as Terry. So that really, on some level, it opened my mind, I guess. But again, I didn't immediately figure out what was going on. It was, this kind of a process that went on. And then one day I had this kind of brainstorm to check on the internet of Americans who fought in the Battle of Britain. And the reason why I felt the Battle of Britain was significant, again, it was early, like the early 1940s, so that could have possibly been significant. I didn't feel I actually fought or died in Dunkirk, the Battle of Britain, I remember even from when I was kind of younger, something about that word Battle of Britain made me feel a bit funny. Yeah, I had this brainstorm to check Americans who might have fought in the Battle of Britain, and there's a list of men, because there weren't that many. There are only a few. In fact, there's a famous quote by Winston Churchill, I think it was, who said that, one, so I think it was something that never has there been so much I would buy so few, something like that. So essentially, these were some of the few that fought then. And I was just searching down the list and clicking a few of the names and thinking, no, it's not this person, not that person. And then there was one name that stood out. I won't say the name because I, but before I even clicked on his name, it kind of flashed through my mind the word South Africa. Now, that makes no sense because I felt I was American and this was a list of Americans. And as soon as I clicked on his name, it said, came up his page, it said he was born in South Africa. And I was like, oh, okay. And the man, sort of his face looked familiar to me. And he matched what I had seen in my mind's eye, like how he looked. He had, light hair, blue eyes. And he had been born to American parents. He was born in South Africa, but his parents were American. And he had American citizenship, so he was American, essentially. And it took me aback a little bit. I was like, oh, maybe. So he actually had fought in the Battle of Britain and died in September of 1940. And there's actually a picture of him standing in front of this really big aircraft. And as soon as I saw that aircraft, I was like, I need to see the interior of that aircraft, because I'm thinking this is my aircraft that I saw a long time ago. And if it's got the yoke and all that, then I know it's what I'm looking for. I'm kind of jumping ahead also because essentially on his page, it also said that he was a hurricane pilot. Again, that was something that kind of struck me, because of the dream I had about the old hurricane pilots. So yeah, the interior of the cockpit, I managed to find that the craft that he was standing in front was actually a Bristol Blenheim. It was one of the early Bristol Blenheims. They flew these from, I think, from 1937 or 38. I can't remember the exact date, but and I actually managed to find a picture of the interior of that particular craft, and it matched what I'd seen. It was a big aircraft, not like the Hurricane, which is a tight, claustrophobic kind of environment. This was a really big, spacious inside in comparison. And yeah, it has the yoke in front. It even has like this lever to the left. I'm pretty sure that's something to do with the engine throttle. I might be wrong, but yeah, and I've seen that again. It was like, whoa, I still didn't believe it. I was still like, maybe there's something to this. I don't know. I think there was an element of denial because, to be fair, at this time in I was I've still been dealing with. Having past life memories are traumatic and difficult to deal with, to do with Vietnam, as well as my own life issues. So I was like, I can't take on another all these more memories and all the emotional crap, essentially. But the thing is, even if you're not consciously aware of these memories, they're still going to affect you on a subconscious level. So for whatever reason, they wanted to come into my consciousness. And as much as I wanted to deny it, it was there. So there's a fair bit about him on the internet. And yeah, I mean, we can mention his name, well, his nickname. He went by the name Ray. A bit like Terry, didn't go by his first name, went by his middle name. And I found that he had been shot down whilst flying over Kent. And it was a pretty bad day for flying, I think, in terms of, I think somebody else went down not long after him in the same area. So it was kind of the turning point of the war. It was the moment where they didn't know, essentially, if England was going to fall to the Germans. It was like that. And he was shot down on that turning point, really. I think it was like an instant death. He was shot through the head and killed pretty much instantly in his vehicle, crashed into the back of a field of a house. Now the funny thing is, that was something I read on the internet. I didn't remember his death, not until later. I was just struggling with accepting having been somebody else. One of the things that I kind of struggled with was he died in September, and Terry was born in December, and that doesn't really leave a whole lot of time between dying and being supposedly reborn. And I remember talking to Jim Matlock about this issue, and he actually said to me, "There's been cases where it's been like minutes between someone dying and being reborn," and he didn't find it implausible.
And the other thing is too, if you look at the personality of Terry, so we assume that Terry and Ray were probably quite similar in personality in some ways because you're the same person all the way through. Terry was someone who was very prone to quick and maybe not fully thought out solutions to things. And so I could imagine Ray may have gone, oh, well, damn, I've been shot down. I'm not ready to. I'll just go straight back, you know, you could sort of see that maybe what might have been what happened.
Yeah, and I think there's something to traumatic deaths where people want to get back quick. It's not always a golden rule, but it seems to be there's a trend from the cases that I've also read, especially suicide cases. Of course, this wasn't suicide, but it was a fairly messy, traumatic end.
If you die like that suddenly, like he's 1 minute he's sitting in his plane, and the next minute he's gone.
So essentially, I'll get back to me remembering the death, because I actually have some insights on what happened. It was around the Battle of Britain anniversary in August, and I was thinking again about him, Ray. And I think I was in a pretty depressed state, and I sort of overdone it with the whiskey and drinking too much. And I remember falling asleep in the living room in my chair. Although I wasn't quite asleep, when you're kind of between two states. And I kind of had this half conscious, half not conscious technical vision of it was the moment I about to take off in the hurricane, and I knew in my head that this was my last flight before I died. And I remember feeling how cramped it was in the cockpit. I mean, being a fairly biggish guy that I was then, it always felt a bit claustrophobic in this cramped place. I remember I'd lost weight, and that I was sleep deprived, so I was in a bad mental state that day. But there was no choice. It was on like, oh, today I'm going to fly, tomorrow I'm not going to fly. It was like, you fly or you die. And it really was not just about me. It was about everybody. I can imagine the sort of sense of responsibility you feel when you think, well, this is my loved ones who could, I mean, it's hard to conceptualize to think that your family and everything that you love and know could just change if you don't get up and fight.
Yeah, I don't think people really fully realize how close it did come.
As far as I know, the RAF was outnumbered, but the Germans underestimated how much, not only the RAF in terms of RAF pilots, but the whole of Britain, because it wasn't just the pilots. It was the radar, the system, everything. It was such an effort, really. And not only radar, but we had people on the ground who were sighting craft and all sorts of things. So, you know, and without that, yeah, the Germans, they would have took over the same they did with France.
They very nearly won, didn't they? They really, very,
They
very
did.
nearly won.
It was so close. And I think that's something that when my mind was back in this state, I was there remembering how it was. And it's hard to put the sort of stress that was. But yeah, the day that I was going to fly, I wasn't feeling great, but you know, had to go up. And I remember actually hearing voices over the radio when I was about to take off. But because I'd flown so much, it was like the plane and me were kind of one. It was like second nature flying. And then I kind of remember being up in the air. And I think this was the moment that I was about to meet I was going to say meet my maker. This was the moment I was about to crash. That I seemed to remember myself sort of banking to the left and then straightening up. And I think I was probably in the middle of a dogfight. So there was somebody I had been engaging with. And at that point, I felt that I got him off my tail, but I was wrong. I think he'd used some sort of technique on me that if I'd been in a better state of mind, I would have been aware enough to not have made that mistake. But obviously I wasn't in the best shape. So yeah, as I was kind of straightening up, I noticed that this sort of, it was like a flash of color, really. It was so fast. I mean, obviously you can imagine the sort of speed that we were going. And I could see the underbelly. It was almost like I could see the underbelly of the German plane. And the next minute I knew my mistake. The moment I could see the visual, I was like, I'm dead, you know. But it was so fast. But at the same time, my thought processes slowed down. And I saw like a this colors, it was like probably red and yellow. I don't know if there was some gray, silvery gray color. And I braced myself for what was about to come. And I saw this really blinding light, which I think was the muzzle of fire probably from the guns of the enemy aircraft. And it came from this side of my vision, which is my right side. And before all this happened, I would sometimes when I was out driving, if something flashed in the right side of my the peripheral kind of part of my vision, I would go into a state of panic, to the point where sometimes I'd almost need to stop the car to calm down. It would feel like my heart would start racing. It was a really strange response, and I didn't even know where it came from. Sometimes it happened when I was driving. Sometimes it could be triggered if I was just, even if the sun hits that part of my face, it would sometimes trigger this really horrible feeling. I could never understand where that came from. And obviously, seeing this in that visual of Ray about to die, it kind of hit me in that moment. Maybe that's where that comes from. But yeah, as I was about to die, I remember I said or thought, I can't remember if I said it or I thought it, this woman's name. And again, this was something I just knew. It wasn't something that I knew, but it was something that I knew then as Ray, that this woman was not my wife. She was somebody else. And Had no idea why I said her name when he passed on, but there was this feeling that obviously something was really important about this woman if I needed to say her name. It was absolutely kind of a desperate call towards her. And the next minute I know there was this really extremely blinding pain, and then I seemed to be just zipped out of my body and out of the plane. And I kind of have this feeling that I was above the aircraft and watching it crash down below. And then I remember being kind of suspended in the air and watching it in the field and not being able to get close to it.
So you were kind of just sort of stuck floating up in the
Yeah.
air, a fair way up, like 30,000 feet or whatever, up. Probably less than that because that's what commercial airlines fly up
Yeah, I
to.
think we were flying lower than that. But yeah, I was kind of above, and
Looking down.
yeah, and I think I tried to get closer. And this is something I talked to, you know, Benjamin. I told him about this feeling of it being like a force field. I can't get close, even though I wanted to get back in my body. And he told me he felt something very almost similar. Like he was when he died in, I think he was in a tank. He also felt his body be. He was like kind of expulsed from his body, and he also wanted to get close, but he felt this force field. So it's really curious that we both had that very similar sort of experience. And the next thing I remember, it kind of seemed to jump, and it seemed like I was in the same aircraft that I flew, not the Hurricane, but this Blenheim, and I was really adamant in the spirit form or whatever that I'm going to make this Blenheim and I'm going to fly to America, because at that point I felt that the war maybe was lost, and from my perspective, fighting the Germans would make more sense from America than fighting them from Britain at that point in the war. So I seemed to fly over to America in the spirit plane, if you like. And then the next minute, I see this kind of tunnel. It was like a bluish light, and I seemed to be there. And my next mum was there at the end of the tunnel. And I seemed to be wearing like the RAF uniform and everything. And she was kind of accepting me and letting me go to her. So that would have been my next mum, is Terry. And then I think I fell asleep. And I didn't re actually remember this whole experience till the next day. And I think I was in the kitchen or something, and it just kind of, I was like, oh yeah, that happened last night. It really blew my mind to the point where I decided I need to go visit the village where Ray was shot down. Because at that point, I thought maybe I'll do it, maybe I won't. But that really pushed me to actually go and drive down. I think it's about nearly a 3 hour drive from where I live, so I decided to go down, and I took my kids with me, so it was, but we'll go down and camp near the area, so not actually the area where we shot, but just around the area, so that I can sort of have an excuse to spend a weekend there. And we drove to the little village where it was, because where he actually was shot down was the back of somebody's cottage. And it's miraculous that the hurricane didn't actually go into the cottage itself, because there's not a lot of space between where it actually did crash and where the cottage was, to be fair. And I went to this place thinking, I don't know what it's going to feel like to go there. And the strange thing is, when we got there, it was like, you know, this feeling of familiarity you get when you've gone to somewhere that you've maybe lived before, but a long time ago. So things have changed. But a lot of it was still the same, to be fair, especially the area where the crash happened. And there's a stately home, I don't know who it's owned by, but it's a really nice manor house near to where the crash happened. And there's a clock tower. And I remember I stood outside of it and I looked at the clock tower and thinking, that looks familiar. I kind of had this feeling that the hurricane kind of nearly hit that clock tower, but it didn't. Again, quite miraculous because it was near the trajectory of the area. And I walked up to the cottage where the crash happened behind it. And as I got close to the cottage, I started to get this kind of migraine pain in the area where supposedly he was shot. I don't actually know if that's the area he was shot because I haven't seen any kind of morgue report or anything, but I know it did happen through the head. So, and then when I walked away from the cottage, that pain disappeared. For me, that was a really strange experience. And what surprised me most of all was it was kind of a peaceful experience. It was nice to see this place that was, for me, had been a place of war, kind of peaceful.
Really peaceful because of what you did on the day, really.
Exactly. But I think I was expecting to feel a lot of anxiety when I was there. And the fact that I didn't was strange. I was almost expecting war when I went there, if that makes sense. So I spent the weekend there, and on the way home, there was some traffic on the road. We're just following Google Maps, you know, the satellite navigation. And it ended up taking us on a detour because we didn't camp actually near the village. We camped somewhere else. But to get back, we had to sort of go near the village area, but not precisely near it. But there must have been some traffic on the road, and it took us on a sort of back road. And as I was driving, I started to get these kind of intrusive thoughts about German warplane formations and some things about how we were defending against the planes coming through by having sort of I can't remember precisely what it was, but I was thinking about Dover for some reason that came to my mind. And then I was like, I'm going to take note of what road this is because it was just like one of these old B roads. It didn't actually have any name or anything, but I'll just write it down so I can check where that was when I get home. And we got back onto the main road, and as just as we were about to leave the area, there was an old Bentley that drove in front of me, and I was like, "Oh, that's a nice old car." And I noticed, like, you know, the Bentleys have they have like kind of a winged emblem. It reminded me of the RAF emblem, so I looked at it for a while, and then I realized the number plate said Ray on it, and I was like, "Well, how about that? I'm just about to leave." And there's Ray saying goodbye. And yeah, and when I got home, I did check exactly where it was. And it turns out when I had that intrusive thought, I was really like right in the area near the crash. Yeah, I was in that vicinity again. So it seemed to be like the closer I got to it, the more I could access those thoughts. For me, that was bizarre because I didn't even know exactly where I was.
That would be expected, though, when you think of people like Jeff Keane and that, and their memories being triggered.
Yeah.
I think because you're looking at the actual sights that you saw back then.
I think it might be like an energy kind of thing because obviously back then I would have been seeing it from above, not from the ground level. So it would have looked different. So there must be something to the fact that areas themselves carry some sort of imprint of
What
memory.
happens?
But yeah, it must be.
Well, if you think about the paranormal aspect and people describing seeing spirits, poltergeists, ghosts, and things, and sometimes they seem to be have a life of their own and they can move in different ways, but sometimes it's just almost like an imprint almost in the area, like an echo in the area where it keeps repeating the same thing, like they'll walk down a corridor, turn around and look at you and disappear. To me, the ones that are more like an echo, I think that's what you're talking about. It seems to be that maybe it's because such intense energy is happening at the time, it almost leaves a mark or a scar
Yeah,
or.
exactly. I agree with you. And it makes sense considering I have a connection there that I would be picking up something. And obviously the coincidence of seeing the old Bentley with the Ray number plate that was.
That to me is classic synchronicity. It's almost like Ray was trying to say to you, even though you're Ray, it's one of those moments where something from the other side is saying, pay attention.
Yeah, and I was also doubting myself. I was thinking, why did I come down here? Did I make the right decision? It was such a palaver, camping with kids, you know. And then I, you know, it was kind of like saying, you did the right thing. And the funny thing is, after that trip, I was driving back home, and then there was a moment where the sun hit me on that side of the face, and for a moment I was like, oh, I should panic. But then it stopped. It was like this thing of that's closure now, that's gone. And to this date, I'm going to say this now, and maybe I'll have a panic attack tomorrow, but to this day, I've never had a bad trigger when I get light hitting that side of my face now.
Wow.
So yeah,
That's interesting, isn't it?
it
That's
is, and it's
amazing.
I wouldn't believe it if it hadn't happened to me, because it was a really strong reaction before. And
Maybe that's why you felt driven to go down there, because you needed to get some sort of closure about what happened to Ray.
I think so. And it was a sense of after I had that, after I recalled the death, if you like, it was kind of like I can't ignore this now. And it was so vivid, that recall, that it was like I have to go, you know. But I felt like a pilgrimage, if you like. I needed to go down and pay my respects a bit.
I think we'll leave Ben's account there for now before we delve back into a terrible tragedy that happened in Ray's life and learn about who the mysterious woman was that Ray called out to in his dying moments. To me, Ray and Terry seem to have a lot of similarity in their personalities. It was 9 years after the tragedy that Ray died, and only a few months later, Terry was born. Were there echoes of tragedy from Ray's past that impacted on Terry's life and affected his decision-making? Did Ray's consciousness really cross to the States to continue on with the war? And if so, was it that subconscious desire that led Terry into a life in the military and therefore to his 2 tours of Vietnam? If you remember from Ben's last appearance on the podcast, he stated then that he opted to return to England to follow his mother. But the interweaving ties between his lives and two countries is intriguing. Ray was raised in England with American parents. Terry was American. But if you accept Ben's account, which I do, he was led to America by the English-raised Ray. Ben himself is English, but he definitely deeply identifies with America. British-born Ben seems to have a foot in both countries, even though in this life he hasn't even visited America, let alone lived there. I suspect Ben feels that his American experiences feel more valuable and real to him than his British ones, and he's often told me that he never really felt like he's fitted in England, even though Ray, although he was an American citizen, was raised in England. Ray chose America for his next life, and Terry was American. So then, why did Ben opt to return to England? It might have been to follow his mother's consciousness, but was it also because he felt a connection to England as well? It feels almost like a Möbius loop that twists and returns to its own beginning. The quote Ben was trying to remember in the beginning of the episode was indeed from Winston Churchill, and it was made on the 20th of August 1940. We spoke in the episode about how close it came to Germany winning World War II, but it's only by looking in more detail that we can really understand the full gravity of that outcome and also to appreciate the Battle of Britain and the effect that it had, and really how it changed history. The word Blitzkrieg has become synonymous with Nazi Germany, as it was an extremely successful method of deployment that they used to effectively bring Europe to its knees. Blitzkrieg means lightning war in German, and it very aptly describes the technique and its use. In order to rapidly engage and overcome its enemies, Germany would create a small front line and literally throw overwhelming force at that area, effectively breaching enemy defences, using supreme firepower and force, and permitting troops and tanks through the front line to roam freely among the defending troops, thereby demoralizing them and causing them to fall back. Their panzer tanks were also remarkably effective at traversing formerly impossible terrain as well, and their speed pretty much turned the conflict from a war to a rout. Germany conquered Poland first in September of 1939, and then Denmark and Norway in April of 1940, and Belgium, the Netherlands, Luxembourg, and France in May of They also used it in April of 1941 on Yugoslavia and Greece, with equally successful results. The Blitzkrieg had been frighteningly effective. The panzer tanks pushed across France hard, and the English, seeing the battle was already lost, started to retreat. However, communication was terrible, and the soldiers didn't even really know where they were retreating to. Small town after small town fell, pushing them back towards the coast, and then as the coastal towns fell, one by one, to the Nazis, finally there was only Dunkirk left to provide access for a seabound evacuation. Troops made their way pretty much on their own merit to Dunkirk, and as they fled, they were joined by the French civilians, their faces tight with horror and misery as they walked away from everything they owned, carrying only their most meagre possessions in an array of carts and barrows, and sometimes only in their arms, passing the bodies of their fellow countrymen who hadn't been so lucky in their encounters with the Germans. Things were looking very dire indeed. England had a base at Dunkirk, and to see Hitler moving so rapidly across Europe and gaining victory after victory must have been terrifying for Britain. However, they gained two pieces of luck from decisions that were made by German commanders that helped them turn the tide of the war. As the British watched the advancing creep of the German forces towards their last remaining base at Dunkirk, knowing they were looking at the imminent defeat of Britain, two German colonel generals, Gerd von Rundstedt and Gunther von Klug, suggested to Hitler that they should put a halt order on attacking Dunkirk so that they could consolidate their previous victories to prevent an Allied breakout. Hitler sanctioned the order on the 24th of May, planning to continue the invasion after 2 days. And that was the first piece of luck, because it gave Britain the chance to evacuate from Dunkirk, and thus began the Battle of Dunkirk that Ben spoke of. The Luftwaffe, which is the flying arm of the military forces of Germany, were tasked with the annihilation of the British expeditionary forces at Dunkirk, and also with preventing the escape of the Allies and French civilians across the English Channel to English soil. The Luftwaffe were brutally effective, and soldiers on the beach were taking heavy casualties. Supplies were short, and people were waiting to be deployed to the evacuation craft on the beach with no food and water to drink, and heavy fire raining down on top of them. Some people went 4 days without water and food under constant barrage from the planes above before being rescued. Soldiers who were there described the sense of despair and futility as they considered their situation, and others described people going mad with the constant stress and fear. A fierce air battle between the Luftwaffe and the Allied pilots was waged who were trying to buy the escape of their fellow soldiers on the ground. Sadly, because the battles weren't directly over the beaches where the troops were, and the fighting was actually occurring approximately 7 kilometres inland, out of line of sight of the people on the beaches, a lot of the soldiers felt that they'd been abandoned by the RAF. In fact, the fighting was undertaken inland to try and prevent the Luftwaffe from actually reaching the beaches. Pilots who'd been shot down were vilified by their own troops and turned away as soldiers refused to let them board the ships to go home. The sad irony was the pilots were desperate to try and get back so they could get back in the air again and continue the fight against the Luftwaffe, but they were so hated by the troops on the ground that anyone from the RAF had to be disguised in army boots, trench coats and tin hats to stop them from being beaten up by their own compatriots. It must have been a very bitter pill to swallow to see the anger and hatred of the men they were trying so hard to protect. A lot of people got out because of the retreat, and that's largely because of the pilots, but they had to leave behind nearly all of their equipment. The Allies ended up saving over 330,000 British and Allied troops, although heavy casualties were sustained. Around 16,000 French soldiers and 1,000 British Army soldiers died during the evacuation. The British Expeditionary Force lost over 68,000 men alone. And the British Expeditionary Force are a home-based British army that went to northern France at the start of both wars, actually, to support the left wing of the French armies in both wars. Dunkirk was almost completely ringed by German troops when the halt order came in. If the Germans had pressed forward and finished their attack right there, the last remaining British troops would have fallen and Britain would have had to surrender. Without the retreat, Britain would have been defeated and come under German occupation. With the British evacuated and France overrun, surrender was the only option left for the remaining French forces, and on the 22nd of June 1940, a French delegation signed an armistice agreement with Germany at the exact location that they signed their surrender during the First World War. With the fall of France, Britain was the last nation standing. Hitler and his war machine had swept across Europe with breathtaking efficiency, and all that stood in the way of Hitler was a tiny island that was slightly less in size than the state of Oregon, alone in the North Sea with the enemy baring its fangs only 71 kilometres or around 44 miles away across the English Channel. There is a temptation to dismiss the British and think of them as slightly absurd with their quirky sense of humour and their eccentricity, but underneath their self-effacing politeness and the ability to laugh at themselves lies a ribbon of pure titanium. They are a tough race, stoic, courageous, quick-witted, with a steely grit that makes them a truly fearsome opponent in battle. They don't give up and they don't complain, they just get on with it. And that stoicism is a fearsome weapon that made them indomitable soldiers. When France fell, the only things that kept Britain from being invaded were the remaining forces that had retreated from Dunkirk and the RAF and its allies. This included the very small contingent of American fighters that Ben spoke of. Initially, Hitler had no plans to invade Britain, feeling certain that Churchill would see the impossibility of fighting and sign a peace treaty. He was so supremely convinced of this that leave was granted to the German troops and the Luftwaffe were moved to other quarters. Even when Churchill made his determination not to surrender succinctly clear, Hitler still clung to the belief that he was bluffing. It took almost a month for him to even consider invading, and it was only on July 16th that he ordered preparations to begin for invasion. The plan was for the attack to be ready by mid-August. To further emphasise how unlikely the thought of fighting Britain was to Germany, the German army was completely unprepared for such an undertaking. Troops weren't trained for landing operations from ships, and nothing had been done to build landing craft for it, because, of course, the natural barrier that also aided Britain was the North Sea and the English Channel. The German admirals were extremely nervous about the risks to their men during the sea crossing and felt they couldn't repel the British Navy once it appeared. So the onus of invasion landed heavily on the Luftwaffe. The plan was to conquer Britain via air and disrupt naval interference with superior air coverage. In theory, the Luftwaffe should have won the day in the same way they had in Europe at Dunkirk. But invasion by sea is a very different kettle of fish to the fighting style Germany had deployed with its fast tanks and foot soldiers. While the Luftwaffe engaged in some early air attacks against British convoys and ports, the rest of the German military scrambled to get the military forces together, bringing barges from Germany and the Netherlands to carry troops, while they hastily trained troops in embarkation and disembarkation procedures from sea vessels. Once they'd rallied their forces and given their men at least some rudimentary training, the invasion could go ahead. There was just one little problem with this plan. The Luftwaffe couldn't achieve air domination over Britain. With the use of an excellent British radar system called Chain Home, they couldn't gain the element of surprise, so the British were able to mobilise planes from numerous airfields to fight them off, when Chain Home warned them that there were fighters coming. To ward off the German bombers, Fighter Command deployed the durable and heavily armed Hawker Hurricanes against them, while the fast and agile Supermarine Spitfires attacked their fighter escorts. Technically, the German Messerschmitts were considered to be superior to the Supermarine Spitfire by the experts of the time. However, they could only offer brief cover for the bombers because the distance was at the limit of their flying range. Also, in order to provide support to the bombers, they had to fly slower and lower, using more fuel. The bombers themselves lacked the bomb load capacity to seriously do devastating damage, and they also proved to be surprisingly easy to take down in daylight. So, unexpectedly, the British found themselves beating the Luftwaffe off. They were also much more systematic and organised in their fighting efforts, with the German attacks seemingly lacking cohesion and planning. By late August, the Luftwaffe had lost 600 aircraft to the RAF's 260, so the British were successful, but the British losses were taking a heavy toll. The units facing the worst onslaught at the start of the conflict, the No. 11 Flying Squad, were fighting hard for their very lives. If they fell, Britain fell too, and every day the question hung over them whether this would be the day they went down and took England with them. You might be wondering, well, if they had Cheyne home, why couldn't they just bring in fighters from other fields that were sitting idle? But as I've mentioned before, the distance from France to England across the Channel is only 33 kilometres, or around 20 miles at its narrowest point, and it was approximately 71 kilometres, or 44 miles across, at the point where No. 11 Flying Squad was stationed. While No. 11 were taking the brunt, more than the other fields, coverage still had to be maintained all over Britain to ensure there were no holes in their defence. Messerschmitts can fly at a top speed of 400 kilometres, or around 250 miles an hour, but they could only sustain that speed for about 20 minutes or so. So, while Cheyne home was extremely helpful, it would have been impossible to scramble planes from all over England to join the fight, and flight teams could really only hope for assistance from the other fields that were nearby. While they could only maintain a speed of 20 minutes, the Messerschmitts could fly for 90 minutes if they tempered their speed, so they had to balance their speed and time in the air to ensure they could reach England and provide any support they could to the invading German forces before turning back in time to make sure that they had enough to get back to safety. Relief for No. 11 Flying Squad came from that second piece of lucky decision-making I mentioned earlier, or I guess you could say it was unlucky decision-making if you favoured the German army. In a somewhat quirky twist of fate, in September of 1940, a German bomber, apparently by accident, dropped a series of bombs on civilian targets rather than the usual targets of fighter command installations. Britain responded by launching a bombing raid on Berlin. Hitler was so incensed by this that he ordered the Luftwaffe to shift its attacks from military targets to London and other cities. Beginning on the 7th of September 1940, London was attacked on 57 consecutive nights. Coventry and Liverpool were also hammered, and these bombing raids went on for several months. This twist of fate of the accidental bombing took the pressure off No. 11 unit, and other units were then able to take up the fight, bringing bomber formations into the sectors of the formidable No. 12 group, who also caused heavy casualties to the Luftwaffe. By mid-September, it was becoming clear that the Luftwaffe weren't able to gain air supremacy, and in fact, Britain's pilots were shooting down the German planes faster than their factories could produce them. On September 3rd, the invasion plans were deferred to the 21st by Hitler, and then on the 19th, Hitler ordered the shipping gathered for Operation Sea Lion, which was what the invasion of England was called, to be dispersed, and on October 12th, he called the operation off due to the approaching winter. Hitler lost interest in invading England, and well before the arrival of spring, he decided to send his troops eastward into Russia, and Operation Sea Lion was discarded. Germany opted instead to merely blockade its own sea advances, which it did largely with submarines and supplementation by the Luftwaffe. This was a truly heroic victory for the RAF, and their victory changed the outcome of the war. I think the RAF and its allies earned every syllable of Churchill's stirring words when he said, "Never was so much owed by so many to so few." Thank you for listening to Reincarnation, Past Lives Revisited. We hope you're enjoying this case. If you have any interesting stories about reincarnation, or if you can relate your own past life experiences, I'd love to hear about them, and I can be contacted through my email at reincarnationplr@gmail.com or via my Facebook page called Reincarnation, Past Lives Revisited. If you'd like to support me, I'd be honoured if you'd become a Patreon supporter. You can find me on Patreon under Reincarnation PLR. I do extra content, and your support helps me to keep pumping out content faster, and it lets me keep on doing what I hope you love hearing. We'll be back again soon with another episode, but until then, remember you are unique and your life has a purpose.